We'll come to order, and just before we get going here, we have some, we can't, okay, we'll wait on that then. Well, thank you for everybody for coming today. As you all know, we're here to talk about autism and related conditions, and the goal really today is to just start educating ourselves about autism. There's a lot of, it's a still a not fully understood condition, I think it would be fair to say, both in terms of causes and treatments and all that. And so as we go forward, I think it's important that we at least have a baseline that we can start to talk about it. And we've invited several folks here to provide some background information to start that discussion. And I'll acknowledge, starting out, that there's a lot of perspectives to this issue. And we do have some information in the packets that go to some of that. And feel free to ask questions as we go, because that's really the point here. And the goal is that the speakers, the presenters, will each do a relatively short presentation to leave time for questions of each of them, so we can kind of fully explore some of the issues that we'll be talking about today. And as I was getting ready, just as a kind of prelude to this, as I was reading about this, it was actually, I think everybody understands this is a growing problem, that there's increased diagnoses in the state and across the country. We really do need to better understand the reasons for that and try to figure out if there's ways we can meaningfully and safely affect those increases. But the thing that really struck me as I was getting ready is the MA numbers for children who are diagnosed with autism in 2004 was about $86 million that we spent as a state, and that covers about 3,000 kids. And on our waiver services, which we've been talking a lot about 30% of the children on waivers have an autism diagnosis of autism, and which was kind of I didn't realize the scope of the problem, even just in our state program. And so I think it's important that we do start to talk about this more seriously, because we're, not only legally, but morally and all those other reasons obligated to provide these services, but it's also a cost driver. So to the extent that we can take some actions to help folks out in addressing some of the issues around this, that probably makes sense. So with that, our first testifier today is Phil Sievers from the Department of Education. He's kind of going to give us an overview just of the trends related to autism in the state. So, Mr. Sievers, thank you for coming.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here today, and I want to thank the committee for asking for representatives from the Department of Ed to come and present some information on the background and trends in the state and also across the country. I'll try to share some of the trends that we observe here in Minnesota, as well as those that are also recognized in other states, and try to answer four basic questions for the group. Who are the students? How prevalent is it in Minnesota and across the nation? What might we predict about the increase in Minnesota? And also what services are provided to students and families? It's a little unique that the Department of Education is testifying, because the services that I'll be testifying about are education services, and we do use MA funds for some of those services. But in Minnesota, we have a birth mandate, so education is the lead agency for infants and toddlers with autism and disabilities. So many of the activities that are in place require the cooperation and collaboration of health, Department of Human Services, and also education. So we're a major player in that collaboration. And also because the figures and data that I'll be sharing with you are usually the figures that are shared by all the media outlets that share about how the increases occurring across the country is based on education data, primarily data that comes from schools that report to the state, that report to federal government. So many of the numbers you see come from schools, and there are research studies that go beyond that, but the majority of the figures that you see in the media come from those reported by schools. So basically, a definition, if you aren't familiar with who the students or who these kids are, they have significant impairments in three major areas: social impairment, reciprocal social interactions are affected, They have qualitative impairments of their communication skills and also have restricted ranges of interests and behaviors. And those might include repetitive kinds of behaviors as well. But those are the three key features. And here in the handout I also have for you is the Minnesota definition in 3525. And this is the definition that guides the identification of students in the state. Each state has a different definition. I want to bring that to your attention. So there is a federal definition that we all come under, but then we also have responsibility to have a state definition, and this is the Minnesota definition you have before you there. Again, I mentioned the three core features. The etiology is unknown, and I know we'll have some other others testify about that this morning as well. The onset is in early childhood and lasts throughout their lifetime, and you're probably aware that four times as many boys are affected as girls. The range of severity is from severe or intense autism to more mild or less significant impairment. So that presents all types of challenges for schools and for service providers. Basically, one size doesn't fit all. Every child is unique and has a different set of needs and different profiles. And again, it's not limited to any specific ethnic group or socioeconomic group. It's across the board. The autism spectrum disorders is an umbrella term, and it has grown over the years from being known as having many different names, including autism or autistic disorder or childhood psychopathology. But now it's known to include this set of at least five diagnostic syndromes: autistic disorder, Asperger's disorder, childhood disintegrative disorder, Rett disorder, and PDD, not otherwise specified. So you'll hear all these terms when we talk about these kids, and each of these individuals presents a different profile and different severity in terms of their needs. This is a representation of the last 20 years of child count data, or I'm sorry, 10 years of child count data in Minnesota. The most recent count, December 1st, 2006, is on the right side of 9,929 students. This is students whose IEP team has found them eligible as a student with an autism spectrum disorder. It doesn't mean they have a diagnosis of autism or Asperger's, but it may. Again, this is that broad umbrella term that the state uses in schools. And this is a count for children birth to 21. So if a child, infant or toddler, is found eligible under this category, they're in this count, as well as those all the way through secondary school.
Mr. Stevens, can you just explain briefly what the IEP, who's on the IEP team and how that assessment would work, just briefly?
Sure. The IEP is the Individual Education Plan. It's a team that includes the parents and educators. That might include related service staff, occupational therapists, speech language, school psychologists, licensed teachers, administrators. And they come together to develop, they first evaluate the child in terms of whether there is a disability, and then if there is a disability, if there's educational needs. So there's sort of a two-prong approach to that. The team then determines what the needs for that child are, and then develop an IEP or an individual program to address those needs.
That's helpful. And then When you say that it's not necessarily a diagnosis with autism as opposed to having an IEP team identifying the condition, Who would do it? Who would make a diagnosis that if it's not, who's qualified to make that decision, I guess, distinguishing it from what the IEP team does?
Right. If a family would like to pursue a medical diagnosis, that's a different course, and that would be done by a qualified mental health professional, pediatrician, licensed psychologist, but not by a school staff.
And do we have any numbers on that? And the follow up would be how that relates to the, you know, where in terms of the health committee, how that relates to how MA dollars can flow. Do you need a diagnosis from a doctor to access medical assistance dollars?
Right, I understand. Yes, we do have some data now from a survey. We don't have hard numbers on how many of these individuals have also have a diagnosis, but we know that from the survey we just completed that represents about half the students in the state, so it's just a snapshot. About 90% of the students with an IEP under ASD also have a medical diagnosis of some type. One of those five I showed you before, or maybe some other diagnosis.
Okay, that's helpful.
So
thank you.
There's quite a lot of correlation there between the two. Okay, good. So this is a trend seen in every state across the country. This is not new to Minnesota, but there's just a snapshot of that. Factors, just briefly, certainly we have better identification and concentrated training to help educators identify these kids, screen and evaluate them. The spectrum is broader than it was. Since 1994, we've added DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual has added Asperger's Syndrome as one of the conditions, and others may follow up with information about that later today. But we've broadened the spectrum. We've trained staff to better identify kids, and yet there's still a possible undetermined genetic and environmental cause that may be contributing to the increase.
And I think Representative Madore has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain to me if these numbers also incorporate a 504 plan identifier for these children?
This count does not include a 504 plan.
Do you have any idea what that number may be? Those would be children that have are receiving speech services that are not fully identified. What?
I would have to bring that information back to you. I don't have that.
Thank you.
Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm wondering, the increase is happening throughout the entire country, there's no doubt. But I'm wondering the rate of increase and how that differs from state to state. Is that something that you can provide me? It's my understanding that there's certain states that are seeing an increase that are dramatically greater than other states. Somewhat curious as to why, what the correlations are, things like that.
Okay. I do have a slide for that. I'll get to that in just a minute. I can talk about that in a little more detail. Thank you. Where these students are educated, like I said, the challenges are great, and the variety of programming provided to students is very diverse. 45% of the students, of those 10,000, roughly 10,000 students, receive the majority of their education in regular classrooms, represented by the blue quadrant of the pie chart. Resource rooms, 29%, and 19% in separate classrooms, where they're there the majority of the day. So I just use this to represent that these students don't all have the same type of programming. And this is a little definition of each of those settings. Okay. Now on to some of the other questions you had asked about other states as well. First of all, is there over-identification in Minnesota? We don't believe so. There's evidence that we're still under-identifying students in the early years, and also some of the age cohorts continue to increase each year. Other states are finding the same thing, yes. We do predict that this trend will continue for some time. We don't know exactly how long this trend will continue, but we do, given the forecasts from the CDC, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, we do expect that we'll see a continued increase.
Do you have information by district in Minnesota?
We do have information available by district in Minnesota. I don't have it here.
Could you just send that over when you get a chance? That would
mm-hmm.
be. Thank you.
Here's the slide I want to mention regarding the rate of increase in other states. This is just some selected states that I pulled up for the slide to show the rate of increase, percent of increase in the last 10 years by these states I represented here. So some states do identify at a higher rate than we are, and some do at a lower rate. And some are the more rural areas as well as some of the more urban areas, like Iowa and New Jersey. You wouldn't see a lot of similarity in their geography or the size of those states, but their rate of increase is about the same.
Representative Norton.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. You mentioned earlier that there are different definitions in each state with regard to autism spectrum disorders or even just what one might include in their state definition. Does that impact at all some of this information that you're showing us now?
Yes.
And how?
Mr. Siebert.
Right. Mr. Chair. Yes, that does impact that. In some ways, it's been analogous to comparing apples and oranges. Everyone follows the same federal definition of autism in the schools in all the states. But within that, within each state, they can then develop a definition that meets that requirement but has different parameters. So it does probably affect the count for different states when you just use the school criteria. course, nationally, the DSM, or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual criteria, is uniform across states. So if it would be a medical diagnosis, it would be probably more likely to be uniform across states. But there is variability within states.
Representative Medor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to ascertain the difference here between... We also, these numbers do not include children in other states that are also on a 504 plan. Is that correct?
The 504 plan, Mr. Chair, I think this is probably excluded from this count, but I'll have to make sure.
Can I ask to give a definition to the committee of...
That would be great.
Because I'm using that term and I'm seeing some confused faces. Could you give a definition of what a 504 plan is and why a student may receive that over an IEP?
Mr. Stevens.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll do my best. I'm not an expert on 504 plans, but they have a different standard for eligibility for a 504 plan. They require a diagnosis, but may not be a child with an educational need. So in special education, you have to have a disability and an educational need to meet that two-pronged test. In a 504 plan, you're eligible with a diagnosis. And there are some individuals who would fit that, who would have a 504 plan because their educational need is so insignificant that it doesn't require special education services.
Representative Gorgie, you have a follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up, yes. And so just for the committee members to understand exactly that, we have many, many students that are receiving speech services or other therapy services, but their educational impact is so insignificant that they can mainstream. So I just wanted to make that point for the committee. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, that's very helpful. In terms of the DSM, is that right? Yeah.
Diagnostic Statistical Manual.
Do we have any similar comparison that you know of that would do that by state using that criteria?
No, I'm not sure that I'm aware of any that does the comparison across state. Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. I want to just go back to this slide briefly. This is the age distribution for that 9,929 students last year. This is how many in each age cohort were identified by schools. And you can see on the left side, those are the infants and toddlers with none identified before the first year of birth, just a couple at 2 and 3 and 4, and so on. It increases. There are individuals receiving specialized services who are infants and toddlers with autism, but if their team uses a different category to bring them into service, developmental delay, which is one of the options, they are not in this count. They're provided service, but they're through a different, they're counted differently. So we all know that autism spectrum disorder does manifest itself in the early years, so we know these numbers would be higher if we were counting all those individuals here in this group.
And is the... Oh, Representative Liebling.
So
no, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to go back to the previous slide. So, okay.
Why don't we do that?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I wanted to go back to this slide with the percent of increase. And as I'm understanding this chart, what you're just looking at the difference between 1992 and 2005 in each of these states, right?
Right.
And
from 1 point to the next.
Okay. And that doesn't really address Representative Broad's question, which is about a rate of increase. And if you have data on that, I think that would be a lot more helpful than what you've got here, because this really, I know you did talk about this, that we are perhaps comparing apples to oranges, but I think a rate of increase might even, assuming that each state is keeping roughly the same definition, that rate of increase and comparing those would really give us a better idea of what we're dealing with, I think. So if you could do that, that would be helpful.
I'd be glad to. I'll bring that back to you.
And just in some information I have, that across the country, the growth rate is 10 to 17%. Does that sound a year? Does that sound about right?
Yes. The 10 to 17% is consistent with Minnesota's count around 17%. Maybe I think this year was about 14%. So we do have that data for our state, and I'll see if I can get it for all the other states as well.
And that information I just talked about is in the packets, apparently. So there you go. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Stevens.
Okay, one final comment about this slide. You'll see on the right-hand side that the number of students in secondary programs is relatively low, but the the take-home message is that it's going to double every year for the next 7 years. So the number of students with autism spectrum disorders in our secondary program will be doubling each year for the next 7 years as these students age into those settings. And the prediction question, this is more difficult to look at than it needs to be, so I made another slide that I'll share with you, the next slide. We did a study with the Department of Epidemiology in 2000 and looked at the last 20 years of child count data and made some predictions regarding what we might expect to see if we had the same rate of increase. And with this, we did an analysis on three different possible increasing rates, three different columns there. And in 2000, over on the left, we only had 2,800 students. In 2005, we had 8,691. And if you look at the center column, we had predicted 8,588, given that rate of increase. And if you follow that line of thinking down the center column, by 2010, we might have as many as 26,000 students in the state. And that's what this chart represents, with the turquoise line being the actual child count. I'm sorry, the turquoise line being the prediction, and the actual child count being the purple bar.
Oh, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Chair Pearson. I'm wondering if it's worth pointing out, and maybe it's not, maybe it's just common knowledge. My first question would be that on the DSM 3 or 3, I guess we're at 4 maybe now, when did the DSM 4 start changing the, or adding, broadening the autism description? About what year? Because I was looking to see if that might have any correlation to some of the stats that we're seeing. That was my first question.
Right, Representative. I believe DSM added Asperger's 1994.
Okay.
And I believe one of my follow-up colleagues will be able to talk a little bit more about some of those issues of diagnosis. But I think it was 94 that was added.
And thank you. If I could follow up.
Sure.
As we're looking at these numbers, and I think they're dramatic changes, and I do think some of it is due to the changes in diagnosis, I'm wondering if there's an understanding that we need to have that autism has an extremely broad range of needs, and from children that are and adults that have an extremely debilitating form of autism to those that function relatively normally with very minimal interventions needed. And so as we're talking about this, you know, in kind of a broad kind of shocking change, yes, but is there a way for us to get a grasp on if the increases in Asperger's and if the increases in some of the milder forms of autism, that will have a significantly different impact on MA needs and education expenses and healthcare expenses? So I'm wondering if you've thought about that and if you have a way to help us grasp with the increased number, is there a significant increase in potential cost, either in, I suppose, in this instance, healthcare?
Mr. Stevens.
And you may not have an answer.
I'm not an expert in the finance part of education, but I could talk with those folks in finance and get some more information for you about that. You know, in a partial response to it, I in the survey we just completed, we found that probably 60% of these children have average or above average intellectual functioning, which would leave the other 40% to have moderate to severe intellectual functioning. So that is another way to look at this, that it's kids who are typical, probably 6 to 1 in this count, look to be of average intellectual ability, but still significant in their needs. So their needs would look very different than a child who has severe autism and is non-communicative, maybe self-isolating and self-injurious or something, as opposed to another child who's making some academic progress but has struggles with social relations and communication, and once they graduate, struggle with employment and independent living and other issues.
Thank you, Mr. C.
Okay. Go ahead. Let me talk a little bit about the services provided. Again, this addresses Representative Norton's comments that, yes, it's a wide range of students, and there's a wide range of services provided to those children. Earlier screening and comprehensive evaluation is one of the services that are provided through school. And at the same time they're going through educational evaluations, students and their families may be pursuing a medical evaluation to rule out other concerns or get a medical diagnosis as well. The programming, as I said, with the IEP is based on individual needs, and specially designed instruction is provided to address the goals in their IEP. And again, it serves in multiple settings. Services provided, multiple professionals are included on the team here. I've listed a few of those. And in Minnesota, it's unique that we have requirements for cessation of a professional with experience and expertise in autism spectrum disorders to sit on the team with for those individuals. We don't have a teaching license in this area, but there is a requirement that someone on the team have experience and expertise. This is just a slide that represents some of the increase in staff funded through schools. Teaching staff, the blue lower line there, paraprofessionals, the pink line up at the top, and then PCAs. You see an increase in all three areas of staff.
And Mr. Sue, the PCAs, that's an MA expenditure as opposed to a education budget expenditure?
Right, I believe so. That would be the personal care attendant.
Right.
Kinds of service, this is sort of a laundry list of all the types of services, and I don't want to go through each one in detail. So you can see the list here includes all of the types of services that would be eligible or available to any child with a disability who receives special education. And again, it would be tailored for the individual child with autism based on that individual education plan that the team developed. And just real briefly, some initiatives that we have in place supporting students in Minnesota. Over the last 3 years, we've been working with the Minnesota First Science Project to educate physicians and or medical practitioners, not just physicians, but medical practitioners and early childhood educators in the early warning signs of autism, and to refer children for evaluation rather than to dismiss parental concerns about atypical development. We also sponsor promising practice workshops and a symposium, and are developing competencies for staff. There are regional low-income projects around the state that coordinate activities to develop staff in all 11 regions of the state. We have in place a behavior intervention, or positive behavioral intervention and supports program that's a school-wide initiative to try and improve the social climate and improve settings that students with autism attend in. Working closely with higher ed, more and more closely through the years now, to develop teacher prep programs and coursework in the area of autism, and collaborating nationally with the Network of Autism and Technical Assistance and Training Programs, where we've been developing modules for training staff, online modules for training staff, and also national teacher competencies in autism. That's what I have prepared.
Further questions? Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering how much of the services that are provided to autistic children along the spectrum are provided in schools versus with other contract agencies or contract groups, things along those lines. And maybe I'm not using the right term, but with outside the public schools organizations, maybe.
Okay.
Mr. Stevens.
Yes, Representative. I'd probably have to get more data on that for you, because if a child is receiving services, private services in their home and not through their IEP, then we wouldn't have any record of that. There's no record there's no educational record that says the IEP team is providing certain services in the home, unless that was the arrangement. But there are cases where families will be doing this on their own and not having the school involved. So it's not clear how many are.
Mr. Chairman, and I can understand that. How about maybe this would be within your purview of how often do schools contract with outside groups to offer services to autistic children?
Mr. Stevens.
Yes, Representative Stevens. I don't have the data on that, but it does occur. I know it's probably seldom, but it does occur that there are teams that collaborate with families for a solely in-home type of service. And I could pick out some representative cases, but I don't have data to say how many.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. I actually would like that information. I'm trying to get a sense if there's, you know, certain practices or certain groups out there doing things that are working very well for these children. You know, certain schools that are doing certain things that are working very well for these children, and trying to get a sense of some best practices that are going on out there.
Right. Okay. I'll do what I can to bring that information.
Thank you. Further questions for this witness? Okay, well, thank you for coming today. It's very helpful. Dr. Allison Golnick is the next testifier. And as she's coming down there, just to be more specific about what's in the packets, we received some written submissions from some folks that are in there. And provide actually some really good information. And then the presentation you're about to see, that these presentations should all be in your packets as well in kind of paper form. So, Dr. Golnick.
Thank you so much, Representative Beeson and Committee. I'm really thrilled to be here. I'm Allison Golnick. I am a pediatrician. Can you all hear me? I'm at the University of Minnesota. And today I'm going to talk a little bit more about looking at this issue from a medical perspective, and also looking at it also from a research perspective, in particular, what can the University of Minnesota do in this area. So I'm so glad that Phil Severs was able to go first and give you really nice definitions for me to go over autism. I have a few slides that will probably reiterate a lot of what he said. I just thought these slides in particular were interesting. And looking at the bottom slide in 2002, you can see that Minnesota is a darker color. So at least at that time point, we were a state that had a higher prevalence. And the prevalence is increasing in all states over time. My understanding...
Can you just go back to that for one second?
Sure.
So Minnesota and Oregon, are those the highest prevalence states then in 2002? We don't have the colors
correct.
On our... Okay.
Those
All
are
right.
the brown. You are
okay.
correct.
Thank you.
And that's from, public school data, and that was in 2002. My understanding in terms of overall country data in the United States is the latest data is, from the CDC showed in the United States that the overall number was 1 in 150. I actually think this slide is just really fascinating, looking at different countries across the world.
Is there any information on differences between those countries that
well,
we know or research on that?
You know, I'm sure I'd have to pull all the different studies to actually look at exactly how they were done. So there probably are some variability within the studies, you know, you'd guess, between different countries.
Thank you.
So, let's see, as far as my first concern that I wanted to bring up, this is a study that I did at the University of Minnesota. It's a national study, and what it looked at was really primary care for children with autism. And I mean primary medical care, like seeing their pediatrician or their family practice doctor. And I think a lot of you have maybe worked with the Minnesota Medical Home Collaborative, so you may be familiar with that term, the medical home. What the medical home really means is I think as primary care physicians, we realized a lot of kids were having challenges with their primary care physicians. In particular, maybe their care was really fragmented over different, they were seeing all sorts of different providers who were not communicating. So when you think about a medical home, probably what that means is somebody can go to their pediatrician and really trust them and talk with, you know, the pediatrician listens to the family's concerns. Their care is coordinated, and so the pediatrician knows when they send them out to see the gastroenterologist. They actually know what happens, and they talk to the gastroenterologist, and then they talk to the family. Or if they're using educational services or family services that you'll hear about, that the pediatrician is aware of those things, and also that the primary care physician knows about those community agencies that are out there to send, you know, to help the parents get connected. So that's kind of an example of the overall medical home concept, which you may have already heard about. So this study looked at children with autism compared to this long acronym, is children with other special health care needs, and that's a Maternal and Child Health Bureau definition. So looking at them, this study showed that, this is a national study, like I said, that children with autism were much less likely to have primary care that met the definition of the medical home. And I personally did this study because I saw some of these challenges in my primary care clinic, and I think this means that a lot of people are having challenges with medical homes, including children with other special health care needs, but it really means in particular children with autism are having a lot of challenges.
And I think a copy of the study is actually in the packet, just for members' information for later.
So through this talk, I mean, one thing that I want to say is that I think models of primary care for these children are really important in terms of their medical care. Since that point, you know, after that I looked at the literature, and there are quite a bit of surveys looking at parental perspective of medical care, and quite a bit of parents are showing, you know, I will say dissatisfaction and some real challenges in their medical care. So I wondered, well, what do physicians think about that? Are they having the same kind of challenges? So recently, this is not published yet, but I did this also, this is a national study, and I asked physicians what they thought about primary care for children with autism. And children with autism are in the very light blue on the left. And so when I asked primary care physicians, do you feel you're capable of providing really good care for these kids? They were much less likely to say that they were capable of providing good care for children with autism compared to two other comparison groups. Now, studies are always hard. You have to kind of choose a comparison group. I didn't, you know, so I chose neurodevelopmental conditions, which might be things like cerebral palsy, or complex and chronic conditions, which could be something like cystic fibrosis or diabetes in a child, for example. So comparison groups are tricky, but at least it gives you a little bit of a perspective. And then the rest of them I asked, do you feel like you have enough resources to do primary care well for these kids, and do families trust you, and are families satisfied with care? And across the board, as you can see, these are all significant, except for the one little star in the first one, that primary care physicians were more likely to say, these are challenges we really see with autism in particular compared to the other groups. So furthermore, I went on to ask them, do you think primary care really needs improvement? And as you can see, they were more likely to say that primary care needs improvement for kids with autism, and more likely to say that they wanted education, and they wanted education in primary care, and also around complementary alternative medicine, which is CAM there, and we'll get into that a little bit also.
Representative Mador.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, was there any did you ask the physicians if they would appreciate having more of a, one of the things you talk about is developing a medical home. I happen to participate in that program. So one of the issues that we often have is that as the primary care physician, first of all, we have an issue with insurance and people having to switch insurance. Has there been a greater need for them being asked to provide case management care for families that in particular might not be able to be eligible for the medical home training that I received, but other families, because the service ranges in each county is different, what the schools provide. So did you ask the question, are you being asked to provide more case management services, and what does that look like for, what impact does that have?
In my particular study, I asked about what are some real barriers to care, and some of the barriers that came up time and time again are, you know, difficulty with not enough time to care for these patients, challenges with coordination of care, reimbursement, education around autism, also for physicians. I think kind of my point in saying this, and then I've looked at the literature, and there are some studies where primary care physicians have shown how much of their office time is spent in coordination. I think probably a lot of that time may be spent in coordination ineffectively because they don't have a good system of coordination. So your question about care coordination is a real challenge, I think, in this area. And certainly physicians are answering that way, saying that that is very challenging for them to coordinate all these services that the kids are doing. A lot of times kids are using various therapies outside of their primary care medical home and various medical subspecialists as well, and family services, et cetera. So to kind of tie that all together, without making that one mom carry around the binder with all of her own information for each position is a real challenge.
Thank you.
Representative Austin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the judge, I wondered whether or not your study was able to distinguish between level of disability, since there's such a huge range here. You know, you have 45% that are, you know, mostly mainstreamed and probably present at the doctor's office not much different than a lot of their caseload, as opposed to those who have really significant kind of challenges. Were you able to break down that difference with how the physician is able to interact with the family?
Doctor.
Great question. As far as the asking physicians about how caring for kids, you know, what challenges they found, I did not break that down by severity, so it's a wonderful question. On the study before in the National Survey for Children's Health that I used, looking at medical homes for children with autism, that was broken down by severity, and we controlled for that in our analysis, so we put that in as a variable so that that was not... The reason why kids with autism didn't have medical homes was not because they were simply more severe than the other kids, so we controlled for that in our analysis, so that is controlled for in that first medical home study. But I was not able to get that information from the physician survey.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. And as far as challenges for physicians, I think one thing that kind of came up a little bit was Phil Fevers in terms of diagnosis and medical care. This is a very anecdotal point, and I think it would be supported. You know, we as physicians, it's a real challenge to get a medical diagnosis for a child with autism, and around our area here, it does take us quite a while to do it. I would say on average your waiting time anecdotally is 6 to 12 months. So that's a long time for someone to actually get in and see a medical professional to get a medical diagnosis. The school system here is wonderful in terms of getting some services sometimes earlier than that started, but that is a real challenge. So I don't think that's the reason for all of these challenges, but that is certainly a challenge for physicians. Let's see. Another challenge is that a lot of these kids have some medical comorbidities is what we call them, and that means medical problems that are more likely to occur in children with autism. So here I have some examples down, sleep problems and gastrointestinal issues, seizures and immune dysregulation issues.
And those percentages mean it's that much more likely?
No, this is the percentage of children with autism who would likely have these kind of issues. You know, these are ranges, so these studies are tricky to do, but certainly these are much higher than the normal population. I was just reading a study yesterday in the gastrointestinal. You know, you'd think more like 10% might be a number in the general population. So these are higher numbers than the general population. And this is a challenge, again, for the primary care provider for these children. So as far as treating these, I think this is an area that really needs more research. I'm going to talk a little bit about complementary alternative medicine. That term is a real challenging term. I've heard many different definitions, but I will tell you that if that's the term we're going to use, much over half of these kids are using these kind of therapies. So I have down here, the surveys have shown really 50 to 95% of kids are using these therapies. And I guess overall, to give you a little better idea of these therapies, they may be newer therapies or they may be old therapies used for a new indication. But typically, oftentimes they're not taught in a traditional medical school. So that's a real challenge for physicians in terms of education also. Some examples I have down here are diet interventions. You may have heard of the gluten-free, casein-free diet. That's a diet a lot of kids are using. And so it's important for physicians to know about that and know how to help kids who are doing that to make sure their nutrition is good. That's just one example I'm going to give here.
Representative Broad had a question.
I just had a question. I've been hearing a lot about a process of pulling mercury out of of children in a certain way, and I'm not able to communicate what that is and how that works. But is that one of these therapies that you're talking about, the CAM therapies, the alternative type therapies to get mercury out of kids?
I would certainly put that therapy into this basket, absolutely. Like I said, it's a really hard thing to define here, but I absolutely would put that therapy into this basket. I actually added this into my physician survey and asked physicians specifically about these different therapies and how they were actually dealing with them, because I think that's a real challenge when these are new things for physicians. I mean, found some challenges with physicians, I think, and, you know, some differences across the board also. So, as far as research in these areas, I think a really important thing that we need to do are a lot of clinical trials. If kids are using these things, you know, the best thing we can do for them is really study them to say, hey, is this helping at all? But that's exceptionally challenging, and I'll get into that a little bit also. And another thing that's really important for us to do is phenotype these kids. What phenotype means is phenotype means what does the kid look like, how do they present to you, and you all know you can't diagnose autism with a blood test. So potentially there are different physiological processes going on in each kid that might even be presenting the same way. So we're just using a constellation of symptoms to diagnose the kid, but we don't really know what each individual child's underlying pathology is in their body. So that's a big area that's needed for research in terms of defining these different groups. You know, if there are different groups, a lot of people will say autism with an S at the end, because maybe it's not only one defined thing that everyone's exactly the same, and I think we're all noticing that it's a very diverse group of kids too. So because of those things I just said, these are real challenges to us. In particular, when I'm talking about doing some studies for these kind of therapies that I'm talking about that are new and innovative, we need to know more about. Children with autism are heterogeneous. That means they're very different. So you might do a study for one of these treatments, and it potentially might work in a small group, but if you're doing it as an epidemiological study, looking at the whole group, that treatment effect might wash out because it didn't work for the other kids. So that's why it's so important to divide these kids into different groups and really try to understand their differences a little bit more. And additionally, a lot of these treatments, maybe you can't just study them alone, but you actually need to study them together because they may work better together as opposed to each one individually. And that makes research more challenging. Doesn't mean we don't need to do it, but certainly I just wanted to at least let you know about some challenges like that. So as far as the University of Minnesota specifically, we've got a lot of people there who are very interested in this area. Some people who are already starting to do research, but we're really interested in doing more. And so I think I've told you what I think is really important is looking at these kids and understanding the differences, and also looking at a lot of these treatments that we don't know enough about, but so many kids are using. And additionally, I think at the University of Minnesota, we are really interested in increasing our services for children with autism, in particular to provide ongoing medical care. And so I think improved models of care are really important. When you saw those studies showing that a lot of kids had challenges with the medical home and physicians are having challenges, we need to also look at, you know, education for these physicians, but also models of care with coordination that you brought up and that kind of thing. So that's it. I'm ready for any questions that you have, and thanks for having me.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question about the research that needs to occur about treatment. Can you explain a little bit about how that research might be selected? My understanding is that it would be, you know, a researcher might decide, I'm really interested in this issue. And it seems like there are a lot of things in that basket. So how do we make sure we cover all the things in the basket?
Doctor.
I would kind of say that twofold. I would say there are probably two main reasons why you might choose to study something. One, just because a lot of kids are doing it, so we need to know about it. And the other one would probably be more of a biological plausibility. If I understand what, you know, physiology in the body, and I think there's some real plausible, you know, that this treatment makes sense to me in terms of why it might be working, that's the reason why I might study it. And one whole caveat to this whole thing is there's so much more to study. You know, we need to study diagnosis, et cetera, but this, I just wanted to kind of focus on these areas for you.
Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Golnick, I'm wondering if there's any coordination occurring between the research you're doing and research being done by physicians in complementary medical practices, because I know that within the complementary fields, there are researchers on some of the practices you're referring to, and so I'm just wondering if professionals are getting together around the table and having some discussions about the research models.
Doctor.
We are having some discussion at the University of Minnesota with, there's a whole division of, or a whole department of spirituality and complementary alternative medicine there. I'm not sure if I got the title correctly, but we are talking to them about doing some research with them, and we could do it more. And then in terms of coordinating research across the country also, there are a lot of different places, you know, quite a few big efforts right now to make national registries and also to make some coordinated research projects across the country so we can get a greater number of children into these studies, because we need a big number of kids in a lot of the studies.
President Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. To follow up on your initial presentation about the medical home-related conclusions, I don't believe I really heard what the explanation is here. I can think of various theories and hypotheses by why this might be true, but if it's true that we see autism across different racial groups, different socioeconomic groups, number one, is there a demographic or socioeconomic explanation underlying the lower access or lower use of medical homes? And is it lower access to them, or is it less appeal to them for some reason of families with autistic kids? And secondly, how are you defining medical home here? What features does it have?
Dr. Golnick.
I'm trying to think back to the exact study that I did. I do not... I know there were no differences in race, and then as far as socioeconomic status, there were not any differences in socioeconomic status either. And I also put those into my equation to control for them in the analysis also, although I can think of some reasons why I might think that that's more likely. Mm-hmm. Thanks. In a little bit here, I'll look to make sure that's exactly correct. Let's see. And then as far as defining the medical home, you can see in this paper the American Academy of Pediatrics gave, I think it's 7 different constructs to think about for the medical home. So then the National Survey for Children's Health, that the survey is from, asked specific questions which are representative of each of those constructs. So for each construct, there are usually about 2 or 3 questions. So trying to think of some good examples. Is your care coordinated or comprehensive? You know, did your physician know about outside resources and was able to present those to you?
Well, Representative Medora has a related question too. So.
I guess maybe thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, and just to follow up to Representative Bond's question here, could some of the issue be, that's where we were going back to the issue of a 504 versus an IEP, and the way the parent's perception of the child's disability is. Oftentimes a parent that I've worked with over the years, if they have speech services, they may have a school diagnosis of autism, but they have never gone to their physician to ask for that formal diagnosis. Could that be some of the parameters here for people not looking to create a medical home for their child with autism? Or are these children that have an autism diagnosis that you looked at for these figures, were they children that parents regularly participated in outreach for medical condition treatment?
Let's see. Let me see if I answer your question correctly. As far as a parental perception, that's a great point, because this study on medical homes was through the National Immunization Survey, and they talked to the caregiver of the child. So this is a parental report study. And then as far as parents talking with their doctor or not about it, it would matter certainly for the medical home whether or not you're getting, you know, services. If you haven't told your physician, that would matter. In this study, we did not measure in terms of, you know, how connected are you with your physician. I suppose this medical home may be a measure of that inadvertently. Mm-hmm.
Representative Fine.
One of the original questions was still the issue, what maybe the study wasn't getting at this, but do you have significant explanatory variables as to why autistic children are less involved with medical homes?
Yeah.
What are they?
I will tell you that this study did not explain that.
Right.
So I think it says in here somewhere, you know, although we cannot explain the reasons why,
okay,
because that's not what this study looked at in particular, I certainly have a list of my own hypotheses, and I think, you know, a lot of those have to do with coordination of care, maybe using some therapies that I talked about that physicians are less familiar with. Those are some of them, but there are probably a lot, and, you know, a lot of people probably have different opinions about that. But that's kind of why I went on to say, well, geez, if this is going on, why do physicians think it is? And that's why I did the physician survey from my own questioning after that.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Golnick, I don't know if you, maybe it's more of a comment than a question. I noticed that in this one slide, it shows that the capacity to provide care, autism, is way down on the list, and recognizing the need that we need improvement in primary care for autism is way high in the list. And I'm starting to, then I think of the classroom special ed teacher. And if many doctors don't feel comfortable or don't feel they know enough about autism, the special ed teachers probably know far less. And I'm getting the feeling that maybe the duty experts on autism might be the parents. Because I know in special ed, we just had a meeting the other night where the parents came and talked to us, and they said, we know more about special ed than the teachers in many cases. And so this coordination of care probably extends out to the parents as well. I guess there is a question there. But,
which slide are you looking at in particular? As far as the capacity to provide care, if that's what you're looking at on the top one on the left, that is how physicians rate themselves, so it's not how important they think it is.
That's exactly.
And I think that this has been such a challenge for families, and that's really what drew me to it. And anecdotally, I agree with you that it's been a lot of families trying to coordinate things here, and I think we're at least these studies are starting to recognize that and to show that we'd really like to help families, especially those that are unable to do that well. So I probably anecdotally agree with you. That's a big challenge.
Representative Broad had a question. I think we're going to have this be the last one for this witness so we can get to others.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Golnick, thank you very much for your studies and your information and all your work with autism. I think what you're doing is absolutely fantastic. One chart you have on page 2, that medical home chart, it says a 75 or 74-26. I think just as a comment, it would be very interesting to see if the 74 who are dissatisfied or not using those medical homes are more likely to use the complementary alternative medicine. I think that's something they mentioned as a hypothesis, and I would find that very interesting to draw that out a little bit more. Just intuitively to me, the answer would be yes, but I don't have no studies to back that up right here today. It just seems like there's probably a dissatisfaction with maybe standard treatments, and so these folks maybe are more likely to go out and get some alternative methods to try to help their kids. But my question really is regarding two slides that are on the back of the presentation. One of them is from a study from Neurotoxicology in 2005, talking about the cellular consequences of detoxification, things along those lines. And then there's a chart also regarding autism, and this is the one I'm talking. I'm just curious what that means.
Let's see. This really just shows that science right now for autism goes really from the family level all the way down to the molecular level now. So we're really looking at some biochemical pathways in kids with autism. And we are, you know, some studies are finding some differences. That doesn't mean for medicine that can translate into medicine for us right away, but this is just a reason why we really need to do more research in those areas. I don't think you really want me to explain the whole cycle to you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Dr. Wills, Doctors Wills, Jacobson, and Luskin, I believe, are at the table next. Thank you for coming. And thank you, Dr. Golnick. That was very helpful. Oh, and while they're coming down, we have a quorum. So, Representative Vaughn, would you move the minutes for the July 11th meeting?
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. Yes, I will move the minutes for the July meeting.
Any discussion of that?
July 11th.
All in favor of their adoption, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for coming.
My name is Laurel Wills, and I am a developmental and behavioral pediatrician at Hennepin County Medical Center, and I spend a day a week at the University of Minnesota, and I'm on the faculty in pediatrics there. I am splitting my clinical time now between our developmental clinic and our sleep center and sleep lab, and you just heard from Dr. Golnick how prevalent sleep disorders are amongst youngsters with autism spectrum. And I wanted to explain my practice and a bit of my role as a medical educator for medical students, residents in pediatrics and family medicine, and to some extent colleagues. My office, the developmental clinic, is literally and figuratively located between our primary care pediatrics clinic and our child and adolescent psychiatry department and our neurology colleagues and our sleep lab and sleep center is just one floor above. So we're all very much in communication with each other. Many of the kids I see, as you just heard, also see gastroenterologists or neurologists if they have seizure disorders and such. But with regard to primary care, I am grateful to the state of Minnesota for having readily accessible evidence-based developmental screening tools online on the Department of Health website that are in an easy-to-read matrix form for primary care docs to help identify very young infants and toddlers with features of autism spectrum disorder early, and then my job is to work with colleagues to mobilize early intervention services right away. And then you've heard a bit about the medical home model, which is largely around keeping primary care clinics and practices accessible, culturally sensitive, comprehensive in scope, and so forth. And the main thrust of that model is the idea of partnering and respecting parents as experts and interdisciplinary collegiality. So one of the jobs of medical education for medical students and residents and so forth is to encourage partnering with speech language pathologists and special educators and occupational therapists and so forth, and to say as a medical provider, our job in practice will not be to provide 100% of the treatment, but instead to really provide a respectful climate of joint decision making with a care team. And doctors and nurse practitioners need to learn how to do that, and that takes some time. I have a theory, the discussion just now, about why it might be a bit more difficult for families with kids with autism to feel engaged and comfortable in a medical home, and that may be because many kids with autism have a perfectly normal physical exam. So it's different for us as medical doctors than taking care of a youngster with asthma or with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis or a child in a wheelchair with cerebral palsy or spina bifida or seizure disorders and so forth, that where the treatment is physical or medical or where there are physical findings and where the treatment may be more in the bailiwick of special education or speech-language communication therapy. So that may be a little bit of an issue. That's a great topic for research. I'm throwing out a theory. The other comment I wanted to make was, again, with my sleep doctor hat on, you just heard that sleep issues are prevalent. Other behavioral health issues are also prevalent. hyperactivity and impulsivity often need to be treated in a child with autism. It's a challenge to live with a youngster with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and you can imagine how challenging it is to live with a child who has ADHD who also is on the autism spectrum. We end up treating a lot of children for anxiety symptoms or other behavioral health symptoms or other kinds of so-called biobehavioral or physical functional issues like toileting problems or feeding problems, so forth. It is the spice of life to be working at Hennepin County Medical Center, and so I just wanted to make at least a quick comment about working with new immigrant families as well as U.S.-born families who have children on the autism spectrum, and it has been a fascinating eye-opener for me to hear from East and West African, Hmong, Mexican, Ecuadorian, families from all over the world, and particularly interesting to me to look at Dr. Golnick's world map and the prevalence of autism across the world. I'd want to hear from families, oh, we don't have autism in our country, and comments like that, or autism is caused by whatever the cultural belief is. Has been one of the most enriching and sometimes very challenging aspects of working with new Americans. So I want to say thank you to all of you for devoting the morning to this topic.
And can I just ask a question, maybe as we're going here, in terms of what you see seems to be, to the extent you do see things that seem to be working versus other things, if you have any comments on that, that might be a little, just briefly helpful
mm-hmm.
in terms of treatment.
Right. What I hear from families in terms of what is working starts with what specifically does your child need in order to be more successful at home or at school or wherever. So you already heard how heterogeneous autism spectrum disorders are. And so the what is working question often has to do with a specific communication strategy or a specific social skills training curriculum or a specific method for toilet training. Or in my world, it may be, I have hit on a specific bedtime routine and maybe a sleep medicine or maybe an anti-anxiety medicine or something like that. So it really varies case by case.
Thank you for joining me. I hope you can all hear me. My name is Dr. Barbara Lovson. I'm a licensed psychologist. I have a practice at the Autism Society of Minnesota, where I've been for
Dr. Lovson, can you scoot over a little
bit? Over?
So we get
okay.
It on the tape.
Okay.
Thank you.
As I said, I'm Dr. Barbara Lovson. I'm a licensed psychologist. I work at the Autism Society of Minnesota, where I have been for 6 years. Before that, I spent approximately 4 years in other working with families with autism in other positions. And I've spent 27 years as a parent of a young adult with autism. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact that children with autism grow up. So I'm going to give you some information on what I'm seeing. Just for the year 2006, I pulled some statistics. Working practice, I'm only working about half-time, 20 hours a week. I saw 178 individual clients, of whom 39% were diagnostic. And that speaks to the comment that was made earlier about the waiting list for diagnosis. Most of those diagnoses that I'm doing are adults. So that, if you look at Phil Siever's graph of we're showing that among 21-year-olds in school, there's a very low incidence rate. Many of those are ending up being diagnosed as adults. The age range, which I've seen, ranges from 18 months to 79 years old. I just diagnosed a 79-year-old last week. The functional range ranges from people who are nonverbal to people who are highly articulate with advanced degrees. I have people working in group homes who are nonverbal, who are being served in the developmental disability system. And I have worked with people who are married, full-time employed, have advanced degrees, and for one reason or the other are still struggling. In terms of mental health, some are doing quite well and just have some social problems, some stress, and others are suicidally depressed or have severe anxiety. So there again is a great range of people on the spectrum. The children that I see, obviously people come to me because they want to rule out an autism spectrum disorder. They're not coming to me because, well, maybe something's wrong, we want to figure out what it is. So the children I see tend to be have been first, autism has been first suggested usually by the school district, sometimes by a daycare provider or other family member, and to support Minneapolis or the Minnesota education system, the school district is usually right. When the school has done a good evaluation, they do a good evaluation. So the adults that come tend to have been identified by a family member who has come across autism either in their own profession or their teachers or nurses, or they've read something and they say, oh, that's John. And then they tell their brother, and who ends up in my office. Sometimes other therapists think, well, this looks like it, but I'm not quite comfortable making a diagnosis. The reasons people have for seeking help, because autism spectrum disorder in and of itself is not something that would necessarily mean you need help. As we've heard, some of them are quite competent. But reasons for seeking help include behavior problems, either in the school, often in group homes, or people who've gotten in legal trouble, which has happened 3 or 4 times in the past 6 years. People just not understanding why their behavior, what behaviors are appropriate and what are not. None of those, by the way, were violent. Social interaction difficulties, and this is very common. Marriage difficulties, conflict with parents, social isolation, and difficulty getting along with coworkers and bosses, which makes it hard to remain employed. Mental health, they have depression and anxiety, and they need someone who understands the communication issues as well as the mental health ones. And they come because they need that diagnosis for access to service, which I think is something you're interested in. If I need Social Security, disability payments, vocational support, you know, a case opened with vocational rehab, case management through the county, I may need a medical diagnosis. So that's one of the reasons people seek diagnoses, is because they need an official piece of paper that says, I have problems. Interventions that I think are helpful to people, to adults on the spectrum, and I think you've heard a lot about children, so I want to talk a little bit about adults. Clearly, mental health issues need to be addressed in people with autism as well as in anybody else, and because they have struggled to fit into a world where they're not quite prepared, they often have issues of depression or anxiety. They need social skills instruction. I need to know that if I never say hello to my coworkers when I first walk in because I can't figure out who's supposed to talk first, they're going to think I'm rude. And I'm going to be the first one to lose that job in that office because all my coworkers are going to target me. They need help with goal setting. That's something that's very difficult for even the most competent person on the spectrum, is to identify possible options and narrow it down. They need help understanding their own and other people's thoughts and feelings, which ties into the social interaction issues. Things that the community provides, and I would like to see more of, that have been helpful are vocational rehab. And I think as more people in the vocational rehabilitation system become familiar with Asperger's syndrome and autism, they're doing an increasingly better job of helping those people find appropriate work. Many of my clients have had to use Social Security disability, either SSI or RSDI. Some of them need help in daily living support, and that ranges from group home level support to ILS, independent living support workers, who see a couple of hours a week, up to 6 hours a week, just to help them with the bill paying and the banking and making sure the apartment's clean, that sort of service. They desperately need, many of them, health insurance. They have difficulty maintaining the kind of full-time jobs that supply health insurance, so they need access to either Minnesota Care or other forms where they can get their health insurance paid for if they don't get it through an employer. Some of them are using various forms of housing support, Section 8 when it's available, or various communities that provide income-based housing support. What I'd like to see more of, and then is vocational support by people who understand the strengths and weaknesses of people on the autism spectrum. Almost everybody on the autism spectrum can, to some degree, be a productive working person. They have many skills. They also have deficits that, without support, tend to get them help make them lose jobs. The social skills that are required are often underestimated by vocational support people who think, well, if you can do the job, you can do the job, and they don't realize that 90% of being successful in a job is relating to your colleagues. They need access to support based on functional skills rather than IQ. I have some extremely intelligent clients who cannot figure out how to budget, who cannot figure out how to look for a job, because despite their success on taking IQ tests or doing well in school, the planning issues are very difficult for them. And they need social networks. They need a place to provide, where other people can provide them access, where they can meet other people in much the same way that many of our mental health centers provide that support with people with mental health diagnoses, drop-in centers, that sort of thing. And most of all, they need awareness and public support. Most of the adults that I work with will tell you that they don't want to be cured. They are who they are, and they're comfortable with that. What they want is the support they need to be able to be productive members of society, even though they're different. And so I think a system that takes that in mind is going to be much appreciated. So that's my
question. Just in that last comment in terms of not want to be cured, I mean, is that a word to be used in this context?
I don't think so, although there are many people who feel that if we could just understand at the physiological, neurological level, we could change it. For whatever, you know, a variety of reasons, the adults feel that that is a, you know, saying that they aren't good enough the way they are.
Thank you. So, Representative Lopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Lufkin. You said that the diagnosis can be, you know, oftentimes it's a key to services, the medical diagnosis, whether it's SSI or case management or a whole range of supported services, but we heard earlier that the lag time is often 6 to 12 months. I assume that, like many other disabilities, that wait time actually reduces, you know, ability to progress and develop skills during that period. And do you have suggestions for us as to what might be remedies to that lag in the current diagnostic?
More people with the training that feel comfortable making the diagnosis. As a practitioner, most of us can do a limited number of assessments per week because it requires time to write the report, for which, for the most part, we don't get paid, by the way. And that just limits the number we can do, and I know that's true at Fraser, I know it's true at most places, so I think the training of people in the mental health profession, as well as in the medical profession, to feel comfortable saying, yes, this is what this is really what we need.
Okay. Just to follow up to that, Dr. Luskin, is there currently efforts or discussion going on with the university and its medical education programs to try and address this in the future workforce?
We're actually working. I'll introduce myself. I'm Dr. Jacobson. I'm chair of the Department of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine, and I'm also a practicing pediatrician and epidemiologist. We are actually partnering with the University of Minnesota in terms of building an autism treatment network here in the Minnesota, working with funding from a national level.
And on that point, the pediatrician, the primary care pediatrician, would not be qualified to make that diagnosis. Would that have to be done by a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
Well, I have prepared a few remarks regarding that. I'd be glad to address it at this time. Or
I think Representative Broad had a question, and then okay. Go ahead. Thank you.
I, as a representative of Mayo Clinic and our Department of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine, I wanted to mention that we do treat, over the last 4 years, treated over 500 children with autism spectrum-related disorders. Many of these children receive ongoing care at the Mayo Clinic in coordination with other interventions that are provided by a local school and private therapy agencies. In addition to that work, we provide comprehensive interdisciplinary diagnostic and treatment services with children with complex disorders. Our research mission at the clinic in the Dana program was established in parallel with our clinical program, and we carry on multiple large-scale projects related to autism, ADHD, and learning disorders with over 13 years of uninterrupted funding from multiple sources, including the NIH, private foundations, and industry. We believe that children with autism spectrum disorders can only be appropriately evaluated through a multidisciplinary team. Children are referred to the Mayo-Dana program for integrated multidisciplinary evaluation from a core faculty from developmental and behavioral pediatrics, child and adolescent psychiatry, speech pathology, medical genetics, child neurology, physical medicine and rehabilitation, and medical social services. At the conclusion of each of these multidisciplinary evaluations, the findings are integrated with team recommendations formulated through a direct conference with the child's family and by a teleconference often, other care and intervention providers, including medical, educational, and community agencies. Patients also have access to fully integrated pediatric practices at the clinic, including pediatric sleep specialists, pediatric gastroenterology, and other pediatric subspecialties. Hence, I would argue that the disease is complex enough that actually requires a great deal of resources and a great deal of support from the state and the country. I think points are well taken that this is we are under-resourced, under-supported in the work that needs to be done. One of our points that's come up in discussion today is the alarming increase in the diagnosis of autism. A recent study done at the Mayo Clinic examined the incidence of autism in Rochester, Minnesota from 1976 to 1997. The incidence of research identified cases of autism based on DSM-4 criteria, the diagnostic and statistical methods criteria established by psychiatry and psychology among children aged 0 to 21, increased from 5.5 children per 100,000 from 1980 to 1983 to 44.9 children per 100,000 in 1995 to 1997. However, it was found that this increase occurred only in children aged less than 10 who were born after 1987. While the possibility that this change really represented a true increase in the number of children with autism could not be excluded, the timing of the increase coincided with the publication of a more precise and broader diagnostic criteria, increased availability of educational services, and increased awareness of autism. There was no apparent association between the introductory of mandatory vaccination for children, the apparent change in the incidence of autism. The findings of the study are consistent with those of a recent review that highlighted the impact of changing diagnostic criteria as a source of misunderstanding about the supposed increase in the actual number of children affected by autism spectrum disorder. Those are probably the main points I wanted to make sure I shared before I took any questions. The care we're participating in the care of children with autism and autism spectrum related disorders. It is complex, requires a great deal of services. There's a great deal of research to be done. It does need to be supported, and we hope that our new collaboration with the University of Minnesota is funded and will lead to better services provided for children. And finally, a clarification in our understanding of the incidence of autism and what accounts for a fair amount of what is attributed to the increase.
Questions? Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Jacobson, I appreciate that you're here, and I appreciate all your research and background and the services you're providing. One thing you mentioned that was intriguing to me, and I know you followed it up in your remarks too, is that you said the alarming increase in diagnosis, not the alarming increase in incidence, and you did follow it up with information regarding the supposed increase in the numbers of autistic children. In your research and in your experience, how much of the increase that we're seeing, in your view, I think there's opposing viewpoints out there, to be fair,
How much of that increase do you attribute to diagnosis versus increase in autism? Because you did mention that you can't rule it out in the studies that you've seen, but I'm just curious your opinion on that.
My opinion is...
Dr. Jacobson, go ahead.
My opinion is that the lion's share, the overwhelming majority... I'm not saying that the parents are not suffering or the physicians are not struggling or the educators are not struggling to provide services, but I would argue that it is through better, more specific criteria that allow for a broader diagnosis, a better awareness across society through parents, educators, and physicians, and frankly, better availability of services. That explains the increase for the most part. From 5 cases per 100,000 to 45 cases per 100,000.
Representative Brown, follow up.
And then I had a question just to follow up with Dr. Luskin as well.
Sure.
And it kind of blends the two together, to tell you the truth, which is why I waited. But Dr. Luskin, you mentioned curing, and I think you said it a little flippantly, which I can appreciate. But to cure something, you have to know what causes it. In your opinion, and maybe Dr. Jacobson, you can comment on this as well, are we making adequate progress towards understanding the underlying cause of autism in children and adults? And if not, why has there been, in your opinion, a lack of focus on that direction? I think, Mr. Chairman, by the way, I want to thank you. I think this is great that we're talking about diagnosis and we're talking about treatment. But I think we're also missing one piece of the puzzle, and that's the prevention or understanding the underlying cause. And so that's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, first of all, let me qualify that I am a psychologist and not a medical or basic scientist researcher. I also, however, am a parent who's probably been reading the literature as long as most of the people in this room. So I think the reason we are not making progress is that we are dealing with a very complex set of issues that are unified by, as someone mentioned earlier, a set of behavioral characteristics. And we're not even sure at this point that those behaviors are always the result of the same initial neurological or physiological difference. So I think it is just a very, very big problem. And it is what, you know, and that's why it's taken on. I think we have made actually a great deal of progress in understanding what the differences are. They're just not at the level yet where there's a direct thing that, oh, we know this, so now we can do this. I think we have much more understanding than we did 30 years ago, certainly of what parts of the brain are involved, related physiological differences. Unfortunately, it's one of those situations where each answer opened up more questions. So,
Dr. Jacobson, did you have...
I do think that we have made great strides in the treatment of autism. I would hazard to say that we actually have successfully cured diseases without knowing the cause. We can cure depression without having a clear idea of what had caused depression. We can cure Kawasaki disease in children without knowing the cause. On the other hand... we had better put a great deal of effort in finding a cause, because for many diseases, as Representative Broad said, that can unlock the secret to treatment. But I would say, in fact, our improved diagnosis has created a great deal of interest as well as funding opportunities. I do think that there is not enough funding for research and that the more effort should be made. But I would argue we are making progress. There are continued studies demonstrating a genetic relationship with this disease. The disease does occur more in some families than in others. There is continued evidence ruling out causes of the disease, which may seem like waste of time, but in the end, showing that something is not related can cause us to stop looking there and redirect our resources. And so I think that research is worthwhile, too. My hearts go out to my families with the child or a teen with autism. They are suffering a struggle that most of us will never know. I think my colleagues at Mayo Clinic and University of Minnesota do see the need to put as much effort as possible in finding the cause, as well as finding better ways of treating autism.
Yes, in front.
Just to follow up, Kawasaki disease, Dr. Jacobson, has nothing to related to motorcycles. What the heck is that?
It's an inflammation of the lymph nodes of the body that can cause a devastating condition of the heart. It shows up out of the blue, sometimes epidemic in communities where children present with 5 days or more fever, enlarged nodes, other associated findings. And it was actually first described by a skin doctor named Kawasaki from Japan, where it seems to occur more often, but actually occurs worldwide in various levels. The point of my argument was that actually we learned how to treat it and make it go away and make the risk of heart damage go away. We still have absolutely no clue why it occurred. That holds out hope that we may be able to find treatments for some things where we just don't know the ultimate cause.
I think Representative Medora had a question, then we're going to move on, but it might be helpful to the extent that it's relatively easy to do. If there's some good places to point us to kind of the current state of the research in terms of causes, both kind of ruled out and where the genetic research is, environmental factors, that to the extent that anybody here has that might be helpful to the committee, and then we can. I'm sure you do. Yes. No, but so well. Yeah, please do. That would be great, Representative Medora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Dr. Jacobson, and I guess I just want to qualify what you're saying. For my community, and we want to understand that if you're saying that the increase of autism is due to better diagnostics, and I'm not going to challenge you on that because I think that there is a finer diagnostic tool for us to use now, especially with the DSM-4 and its expanded categories there that we can look for observation. I'd like to find out from you though. Do you believe that where do you think these numbers have changed from? For example, many of these children, if they presented themselves in the 1960s with these sorts of disorders, and perhaps they may have been diagnosed with Tourette's, or are you trying to present that the number of children must not necessarily have changed that have been diagnosed with disorders, but now we are better diagnosing them as autism instead of Tourette's or or some other?
Yes, actually, a fair amount of nonspecific mental retardation as a classification was reduced. At the same time, we increased our diagnosis of autism. A number of educational and social disorders dropped as we increased the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. So it was more of a reduction of these nonspecific and relatively unhelpful terms, and a movement into more specific and more helpful terms that really drove the lion's share of the classification.
I just want to understand that again. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That you're not saying that autism has, if the number of children that have been diagnosed has significantly improved, and therefore we've seen an increase. Not necessarily the symptoms that we're now putting together to create an autism diagnosis have necessarily been changed. I'm trying to understand.
I think that's correct. I am not saying that what I am saying is that across time, the symptomatology, the parent suffering, the school teacher struggling with their students has remained the same, but we have better named the diagnosis, we have more awareness, and we can bring them more services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor.
And one final comment. Doctor, go ahead.
I would just clarify also, as a developmental pediatrician, one of the things that accounts for at least some of the increase in diagnosis is the ability to characterize children with neurologic impairment as possibly having double or dual diagnoses. So, for example, you may have a child with some degree of mental retardation who has terrific social skills at their level of cognitive functioning, and you also may have a youngster who has some mental retardation who also has autism, who has the specific core features of autism spectrum disorder. So it is not always an either or, and the diagnostic acumen makes all the difference in helping the special educators to design an appropriate, and then again, working side by side with your psychologists, occupational therapists, speech and language professionals, and so forth, to design an appropriate treatment plan that will meet an individual child's multiple needs or multiple diagnoses, if you will.
Well, thank you for coming down. It's been very helpful. We appreciate it. Pat Pulis? I'm sorry, if I, police. All right. And Rachel, Dr. Brandel. And please just identify yourselves for the record and then go ahead. Thank you for coming. And we have about, you know, 18 to 20 minutes here and one other testifier, so okay. I apologize, but that, just keep that in the back of your mind.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Shelley Brandel, director at Fraser Child and Family Center, and my colleague Pat Police, who is director of the autism services at Fraser. We're very happy to be here. Thank you for having us. Our task today is to give you an overview of what services we have for children on the autism spectrum at Fraser Child and Family Center. Fraser has, is as the umbrella organization for Fraser Child and Family Center, Fraser has over 70-year history of serving children with developmental disabilities, including children with autism. In 1994, Fraser acquired the a program for early childhood services that were started by Minneapolis Children's, and actually our Fraser Child and Family Center had its origin at Minneapolis Children's Medical Center in the middle 70s, and so we have had dedicated ourselves to treating children and families on the autism spectrum for more than 20, almost 30 years. The mission of Fraser and in all of its programs is to help individuals and families achieve their potential. We have three divisions, so there are seven subgroups and seven program areas or divisions, and I'll get to that in a minute. They divide into health, education, and housing. And on the next slide, we have here the seven divisions with Fraser Child and Family Center has really some input into all of the divisions in terms of offering consultation to the other divisions regarding autism. The divisions include Fraser Preschool, which was the first Fraser program that was developed, and that was 70 years ago developed by Louise Whitbeck Fraser, from which we get our name, an inclusive preschool that includes children with developmental disabilities as well as typically developing children, so it's an inclusion model. Very successful model of preschool. Fraser Residential Services were developed when many of the individuals that were diagnosed with autism were aging or getting older, and families needed to find services or residential placements for their children. And so at this point, there are about 30% of the residents in the residential program that are have autism disorders. Fraser Rehab includes speech and language, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and music therapy. And those services are available at the Fraser Child and Family Center for children in our program. Fraser Academy is a school program that we support, that Fraser supports, and it's its own separate charter school. And it does include, again, as an inclusive model, children with developmental disabilities, particularly autism, as well as typically developing peers. Fraser Community Sports includes services such as PCA, wayward services, respite care, etc., in-home family-based services. And then the Institute is how we offer training to the community, and also some products that have been developed for children with developmental disabilities. You should type in if I missed something. and here we have some of a detail for what services are offered at Fraser Child and Family Center. The largest program is the autism program, and that has been growing over time. Pat will tell a little bit more as the director of that program. She'll tell you a little bit more about specific services from development, from the diagnostics through treatment. The Child and Family Mental Health Program has been a part of Fraser Child and Family Center since its inception in the 70s. And that program provides day treatment for preschool age children. And these are children with severe emotional disturbances. Most of the children in that preschool day treatment program are in foster care or in some transition. They've been removed from their homes because of neglect or abuse. And the purpose of the day treatment is to help these children learn how to form attachments and to stabilize their lives as they move from some temporary living situation into more permanent. The neuropsychology clinic has also been a part of the of Fraser Child and Family Center, and for almost as long as the other programs. And the children referred here are children with traumatic brain injury or often diagnosis for a learning disability. They also see some children for diagnosis of possible autism spectrum disorder, but a variety of neurodevelopmental issues are evaluated through that clinic. And then rehab services of the support of speech and language, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and music therapy are available. In particular, are important aspects of treatment in the day treatment program. Fraser is a private nonprofit organization. It is also organized and a member of the Community Association of Community Mental Health Programs at the Community Mental Health Center as identified by the Department of Human Services. And we are also identified as an essential community provider. We do serve children birth through adulthood. We do have services across the age spectrum. And our services are definitely family-focused. We really work very hard in doing from the diagnostic all the way through treatment to work with families, collaborate with families to identify what they feel are their child's primary need and then develop a prescription of services that meets those needs and then all through make sure that that there is satisfaction with the services that they are receiving. We're also a Rule 29 clinic, certified through the state of Minnesota. I raise these kinds of associations because they all provide regulatory requirements for an agency in terms of how you do your diagnosis, how you do your treatment. We are dedicated to best practices and to following all the regulatory guidelines that are established by the federal government, by the state, and also by insurance companies who also have their own set of specifications. Pat will talk to you a little bit more about how we do our treatment, our diagnostic and treatment work at Fraser Child and Family Center.
Thanks, Bill. I'm a psychologist on staff and have been at Fraser actually for over 20 years. Did both undergraduate and graduate work there, so I've worked with this population and these families for quite a few years. Currently, in terms of our services, as Shelley mentioned, they are guided by a number of standards, and including DHS, where they give us pretty clear standards about that diagnostic evaluation. Not only are we looking at the component of autism, but I think it was Dr. Will said, what is the concern that brings the family into the clinic? And autism is a very heterogeneous population, but what is concerning to the family and impacting on daily life may be different from family to family. So we're not only looking at it in terms of that diagnosis, but what can this family, well, the families are very different in what their needs are. We are required to look at medical necessity criteria in order to establish a level of care and identify what the needs are and what services are available. And from that, the treatment plans are individualized, and they might include therapies for the family, individual skills training for the child,
family support services, training for family members. Sometimes it includes grandparents. It might be TCAs. As we talk about further, there really is a menu of services and service providers, and I think I've heard other people here today talk about how extensive the range of services and how we need to collaborate and work together. In terms of our outcomes, the treatment plan really provides our guide for the change that's occurring with that child, and along with DHS requirements, we're looking at renewing those every 90 days and looking at the outcome based on the goals that we set. We also do aggregate data for our programs in general, and serving the autism spectrum disorder, we're also serving some children who are regressing in their development, so their goals and their treatment plans and their progress are going to look very different than children who might have either mild forms of autism or more severe forms of autism. We also collaborate with various people over at the universities and graduate students who are doing individual and or group research. Although as a service agency, we don't have the direct funding to participate in research activities, but usually collaborate along with others. We do serve a broad range of families around the 9 county metro area, cuts across all socioeconomic classes, it's culturally diverse, as I'll talk about. Insurance coverage may range from MA, HMOs, other insurance providers, as well as self-pay services.
Do you have a kind of percentage division among those, that you know of?
About half are MA, actually.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yep. Multidisciplinary staff, psychologists, social workers, as a mental health clinic, of course, we're looking at licensed professionals in their area, in that particular area. Also have mental health practitioners. We do have rehab staff, DCOT, music therapy, and have a lot of collaborations with people around the metro area in terms of family community support, medical care, et cetera. Fraser Child and Family Center in its history has been recognized over the course of time, both by the Autism Society of America. We've had pediatricians come and spend some self-study time and refer their graduate students as part of their training. We've also received preferred provider status from HMOs, and more recently we've combined our efforts with UBH to create a bundled model of service, which helps eliminate some of the hoop jumping and the prior authorization process so that we can get families direct help as soon as possible in the areas they would need. So, for example, we had a child in our day treatment program where the doctor was trying to study and diagnose whether there was a curvature of the spine and whether there were medical issues, but couldn't get the child to stand in order to take the x-ray. And we were allowed with this new bundled model to actually take some staff and do some practicing and work with this child. So even though after 4 attempts to try to get that x-ray didn't work, once we were able to have the staff go along and do some practicing, standing on the square, on the floor against the wall, the fifth try we were able to get that x-ray so that this child could receive the medical care that they needed.
Is that done on an case-by-case basis that you negotiate with the insurance company, or do they, how does...
We were approached, first of all, by Medica, by UBH, saying that they were concerned because it was a long wait to get in for the diagnostic evaluation. We were concerned, too, because as the incidence has increased, we've been getting more requests for evaluation. They're complicated, multidisciplinary evaluations that take time. So we talked with them about their funding, are starting what we call bundled services, to start some support services to families so that we can reduce some of the crises around having really confusing behaviors that families didn't know how to deal with. So we could start to do some work with the families around developing skills to manage some of the child behaviors. That was a very successful model, and we actually reduced our wait time for those families with those insurances from 7 months to 7 days. We could see them for skills training within a week. And so after we developed the model, the other insurance companies have come on board. So
okay, and so this is not where you set a get a it's not a capitated rate for all medical services related to a particular child. It's just to be able to kind of use payment streams to pay for a variety of services
right.
that the child needs.
And okay. it could be, for one family, it would be very different what it would be right. for another family.
Okay, so that's helpful.
Specific to the needs of the family at the time.
It relates to some other work that some of us are doing. So that's helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the scope of our services, I just collected some data based on this last year of services, just in particular with the autism program. I should note that other programs within Fraser see these children, but at our particular clinic, we did 588 evaluations this past year, served 202 children in day treatment, provided case management with county support in 84 cases and therapy with families and children for 531 clients. Just in FGFC alone, then, combination services equals over 1,000, over 1,500 children. When I collected current data, we take, our intake people take about 46 calls each day, and about 22 of those calls that are just coming in off on the phone have questions regarding autism. We continue to do about 45 evaluations a month. We're seeing children younger. We're seeing children older. And our average age, while it's 7.8, we've had a 13-month-old come in, as well as a 3-month-old, and also, again, see young adults. Many of those younger children are coming in because they're family members of other children who have already been diagnosed with autism. We currently serve about 200 clients in our residential setting, and about 1/3 of those have autism spectrum disorders. And in our community support, where we have PCA services, about 64% have ASD. So all of our programs are seeing this. We also serve diverse cultures. We have been working with a Somali community who has told us that there's no words for autism, which creates some barriers when we're talking with families. There's a list of some of the interpreters that we've contracted service with just within the past 3 or so months. We also have hired a multicultural specialist on our team. Because of the growing issues in serving clients where English is a second language or maybe not a usable language for the family. Other people have already mentioned we see a lot of dual diagnoses, more complex kids who have other things going on, sometimes medically, sometimes in the area of mental health. So we might see a child with Down syndrome along with autism, but it creates a picture difficult to diagnose as well as to define the areas of treatment. The diversity of the family needs are also great. If we look at the research, many of these families are stressed by parenting a challenging child, and we might see higher rates of separation and divorce in these families, so we're dealing with issues beyond just parenting the child with many of these families. Multiple family members with special needs, twins, triplets, quintuplets. We saw under this bundled service model, we were able to go to the home of a young family who had quintuplets. 4 of the 5 had special needs, and 2 out of the 5 had autism. And with this bundled service model, we were able to do the evaluation in the home, so we didn't really have to require this mom to leave the home with all 5 children to come to the agency. Our scope of funding, as Shelley will talk about, is broad and range.
And like we mentioned, about 1/2 of the kids are funded through medical assistance, or PMAP. Insurance and self-pay, a number of our services have to be self-pay because the family may not have funding for it, but especially things like parent support, grandparent support, educational kinds of programming, the payers aren't covering, so the families will need to cover that on their own. We do have...
Is the state covering that kind of stuff?
The state?
Yes. Is no. MA cover that versus the private insurance companies? Is there a difference between, in terms of the kind of associated support services?
Well, I suppose that under the bundle, we could have some of that covered up by insurance companies under the bundle. It's not covered by the state currently. We also do have established a scholarship fund so that if there are families that cannot fund some of these supports, which we feel are very important, we can scholarship them into that. Also, for some of the training that we do through the Institute, we can offer scholarships to families that really need it but have no way of paying for it.
To the extent that you could follow up and get to Jen kind of what's covered and what's not by, in terms of the services you provide, by MA and then by private insurers, that might be...
Oh, the difference between what the private insurance would pay versus the state?
And what they would cover.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Both those things, actually. Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
That would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Yeah. A collaborative approach, a lot has been said here this morning about the need for collaborative approaches, and that certainly is a major way in which we try to intervene. When we do a diagnostic assessment, we gather information from everybody that's been involved with the child prior to coming to us. Our evaluations are multidisciplinary when they come to our site. But as far as communicating then with other providers, we will always send out reports of our evaluation to physicians. We're in frequent contact with physicians by phone. Our day treatment staff in particular, and particularly the case managers, are really coordinating a lot of the care that these children are receiving, whether it's medical. Every child has, we have contact with the school to be sure that the child is getting adequate services through the school. So collaboration is an extremely important aspect of what we do at Fraser Child and Family Center.
It especially becomes essential. We have a higher number of children where parents are seeking out medication interventions, and I can think of 1 5-year-old in our program who is on 8 different medications. We're very concerned about that medication kind of combination. Parents are looking for ways to deal with the challenging behaviors, and in that case we're staff, for example, frequently visit the doctor's appointments and with frequent calls and frequent check-ins to make sure, again, that this approach and collaboration for looking at what are we focusing on, what are we addressing, and is it doing the trick.
The menu of services, and I don't know if it's given you a very clear understanding of the kinds of services that are available at Fraser. Day treatment is a 3-hour-a-day intervention. We have morning program and afternoon program. And the types of interventions are tailored to each child's need. And though there is a symptom cluster that identifies children on the autism spectrum, each is very individual and unique. And so we look at what the child's strengths are and what the child's needs are and tailor make a treatment plan for each child that's individual to their strengths and needs. Early childhood focus for day treatment, and that's our half-day program, but we also have day treatment for adolescent age youngsters, which is an after-school program, and we have a number of groups, social skills groups as well for children and adolescents in particular.
We only unfortunately have about 2 minutes.
I'm sorry. Family guidance is a big part of what we do, coordinating with medical professionals, and we mentioned the county services of case management, respite, etc. Future directions, we're all faced in mental health with fears about funding cuts, and as a not-for-profit, one always has to stay ahead of the game in trying to anticipate where the cuts are going to be coming from and how we're going to adapt to it.
Okay. Well, on that point, did the legislation that we passed last fall with mental health funding, how does that affect the the work that you do?
Well, it will help us very significantly. Yes. On top of that, though, the county is cutting back. We're kind of threatening to cut back on case management, which is an important aspect of what we do. So,
That's what I say. We have to stay a step of the game, ahead of the game all the time.
That's a good point.
That increase in funding was very, very...
Well, the case management is a great point, though, and I hadn't thought about that because that is a really serious issue, both federally and state level, so... Thank you. President Bunn had a quick question.
The quick question is in terms of our earlier discussion, in terms of when you use the word treatment, what portion of that is behavioral treatment versus pharmaceutical treatment versus complementary alternative medical treatments, giving parents either knowledge about or directing them to resources about, you know, nutrition, intervention, all these other things that are out there in the autism community?
Right, our treatment would be directed by a mental health treatment plan, so it does include behavioral interventions. It includes interventions that would focus on adaptation, stress within the family, within the child, coping, maybe safety at risk behaviors, strategies, and also psychoeducational training.
We do, though, have a resource handbook that we brought today, if you're interested. For families that list all the resources that they could access out in the community. It's not that we're recommending making particular recommendations, but we're listing for them what resources are available for them to seek further information.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Reverend Brock.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted, I have one question for Dr. Jacobson again. I've been looking at the numbers and at one of the charts, and it's just not adding up for me, and I thought maybe you could help me understand better what I was looking at.
Okay.
So just after these two are done, I just wanted to make sure that you knew I had that question before the hearing was over.
Okay. I'd like to go to Mary Powell first, who is the last testifier, and then we can come back then. Maybe if you want to go talk to Dr. Jacobson so he knows what your question is going to be, and then we will get the answer, though, as part of the hearing, so just to speed things up. Thank you for coming very much. It was very helpful. Thank you. Ms. Powell, and we're already over time, and please proceed, but just keep that in the back of your mind. Thanks.
Proceed quickly. I will cut to the chase. I'm the executive director of the Autism Society of Minnesota. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting us. And I am not going to talk about the Autism Society. There's a handout there if you're interested in that. I instead am going to focus on the needs of families because that is basically what we do. We're an organization that really has its birth from meeting the needs of families, and we've been around since 1971. When parents seek a diagnosis for their child with autism, they often find it very difficult to get the diagnosis from the pediatrician. I'm not criticizing the pediatrician, but I want you to know this is a lengthy process, and many times people go multiple places before they get that diagnosis. And it's highly stressful for the family. I'm basing this information I'm giving you today on the fact that we run an information service, and we have a membership of families at the Autism Society. So our information comes from the grassroots. In addition to getting the diagnosis, the family often has a great deal of difficulty understanding the core problems because you now know from the discussion today this is a complex disorder. And so it's very hard to know exactly what you need to do for your child. And basically it comes down to the parents feeling very overwhelmed. This leads me to making the case for case management. The family struggles to kind of put it together in how do I make the right choices. And the bigger problem for them is they're always feeling like there's a window of opportunity. And if they don't act wisely, they will miss chance for their child making the greatest improvement. And research does support this window of opportunity, but children with autism make gains throughout their lives. But most families do feel like I've got to get in there and get going. The point of contact for almost all families is public schools. But the public schools only give you what the school district is willing to pay for. And that's where the rubber hits the road, is they don't offer intensive intervention for children with autism. And since 1994, we have known that intensive intervention shows great improvement. And the case for this, I cannot overstate. This is what families are feeling like. I need to get contact with other providers, and I need to make wise decisions about that. And then once they begin to pick those interventions, and you've heard these titles, right? They could go to Fraser. They could go to an ABA agency. They could go to a speech therapy clinic. They could, they can't come to the Autism Society, and that's why I can speak about this. But when they make those choices, then they have to put together the funding for themselves. And this is not, they do not automatically have access to MA to fund the choices of therapy, because, of course, not all therapies are equal, and we haven't really had that discussion. But we do know there is not one therapy or one approach in autism which is the most effective. And research has not substantiated that one intervention is the way to go. And I cannot state that strongly enough. So we would not want to say all young kids with autism need to have this particular plan of treatment.
Can I just follow up on that? So the in terms of the state covering through like a health insurance kind of model, or the health insurers, they will cover some treatments and not others?
Health insurers, Blue Cross Blue Shield covers ABA therapy. But I don't know if there are any other health insurance plans that cover that. So people have to pick and choose and struggle with their insurance company and then, you know, access MA if they can. But this is a lot of work for a family that is also trying to get their child to sleep and toilet train the child and get the child sort of, you know, prepared for school in some form.
And what about the state in terms of covering different treatments that through MA?
Well, through MA, the parent can use some MA dollars to cover applied behavior analysis, ABA. They can use some MA to cover treatment in a program like Fraser or St. David's. And they can use some insurance money to cover speech therapy and occupational therapy.
Okay.
But in autism, there's a whole range of other things, plus all of these medical treatments that are not really mainline medical treatments, and that's a very challenging route to go to.
Okay.
But if you understand the stress of the family,
no, absolutely.
That's why they're driven to do this, and we are an agency representing a lot of people who are 10 under the gun. I mean, they're not feeling comfortable with what they're getting, and there's a lot of stress and strain in autism.
What in the door did you have?
Yes, I'm stressed and strained, Mr. Chair. I would just like to speak to what the testifier is speaking to. Oftentimes, to clarify for the committee, oftentimes what happens is once you get that initial diagnosis, you go, if you don't have a medical diagnosis, which you already heard can take up to a year, then from there, if you have insurance that will cover this, you have to be willing to have a mental health diagnosis on your primary care insurance, which a lot of families are very uncomfortable with. So they try to supplement these services by asking for sliding scale, that sort of thing. The funding has been cut to these agencies. Oftentimes families are not allowed. So then what they do is they try to then go for their MA. Oftentimes when the families are then evaluated for that, I'm sure the committee is well aware of our extraordinarily high TEFRA fees that we charge the families back. So although they need to have access to these services that may cost, say, several hundred dollars a month, they may be looking at parental fees in addition to their primary pay, their private pay insurance to their employer, of well over $300 to $400 a month. So you are talking about stresses on families that are unimaginable to the average private pay insured in this room. And I would like to just say I've been very impressed with the services over the years that the Autism Society has tried. They work very hard to try to bring
Collaborative, and I wanted to take a minute to Fraser. I've been a recipient of their services many times, and I've been very happy along with the U of M, but it is a very much a struggle to find what therapies we want to use and then how do we go about paying for them, because if you don't pay your TEFRA fee, then we turn around and we lose access to other supportive services throughout the state, and then families are looking at liens on their homes. And so I'd like to see us maybe talk about having a hearing that can deal with treatment and the impact, the financial impact on that for families, because it is devastating to have a child at 8 years old be diagnosed with a chronic condition that costs you thousands of dollars a month to treat. So,
well, I think it's a point well taken. We actually, I think we do need to wrap it up here, but I think this is maybe a prelude to something more that we can go down. So I thank you very much. Did you have some? I don't want to cut you off and have some on some concluding comments you might have.
It's hard to conclude under this much stress and strain.
I'm sorry.
I was just getting rolling, actually.
I know.
I do want to make one other point in terms of waiver services and the waiting list, because you've heard that the waiting list in waiver services is very long, and this is another problem in funding for parents of kids with autism. And one other area that is enormously difficult is many children are diagnosed, and everyone wants their child to have high-functioning autism, or just a little sprinkling of it. But actually, many families find over time their child needs significant support. And it's very difficult for those families to have their child qualify for a DD label. Mm-hmm. And because of the statute that and for eligibility and developmental disabilities, the other related condition statute really doesn't permit counties to identify those children under DD, and so a lot of those families really do not get the appropriate supports that they need, and their child has really difficulty handling life skills. And I don't mean getting a job. I mean learning to use the toilet appropriately and that kind of thing.
So the way that other related conditions is defined in statute excludes certain children, that's the point. Okay.
Yeah, well, the terminology is autism there, and that's a very narrow term.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's very helpful.
So that's my two bits.
Well, I think that we probably will be having you back. So I apologize for having to cut you off, but thank you for coming in. Thank you to all the testifiers. I think we want to just wrap this last piece up here, if Dr. Jacobson would come back down. And as that's happening, I also want to just acknowledge Jen McNerney, who pulled all this together, and I think she did a great job doing that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, Ben always does a great job.
Yeah.
So, and thank you for allowing me this time, too. I always enjoy talking with Dr. Jacobson. I always learn a lot, even though I don't always agree. So it's good. One of my questions and the reason for bringing Dr. Jacobson back down is that, Mr. Chairman, this is the chart I had some concern about. It was Mr. Seaver's chart. And when I looked at the numbers, you know, I'm thinking about the rate of autism and things along those lines, and it just wasn't squaring to me that if, as Dr. Jacobson argues, that everything or the increase is heavily focused on or due to diagnosis in for the most part. It just didn't work for me in terms of how I looked at this chart that 17-year-olds would drop off that dramatically from 400 to the highest rate for 9-year-olds as the 9-year-old at the 800 number on this chart. And so I just wanted him to talk a little bit about that drop-off. You know, that would imply to me, and this is what we talked about in the hallway, that those kids were essentially ignored for 8 years, and that just doesn't make sense. So I'm struggling with the numbers, and I just wanted to have the opportunity to ask that question. The rate of autism, it seems to me, is definitely increasing. I think Dr. Jacobson argues other than that.
Dr. Thank you. I appreciate it. What I had said before was that the rate of diagnosis has increased for three main reasons. One is the broader diagnostic criteria that allow us to diagnose autism spectrum disorder and related disorders where we didn't have the capabilities before, increased awareness from on the side of parents, providers, educators, physicians, and then in addition, increased services that make it easier to make the diagnosis because you can actually provide treatment. I would argue that I understand where Representative Vaught is coming from. Theoretically, if it was just a new and expanded increase, we would see the increase each in each new age group from 1 year up, and you wouldn't see a drop-off at age 17. But children with ASD, unlike autism, can float along in the school system undiagnosed and did. When in my generation, they became the early dropouts, the problematic boys, and without a great diagnosis and without great services, the family suffered more than any other group. I think society also suffered a loss, but it wasn't felt as hard as the family felt it. The increased diagnosis that we see, the work that has been occurring since 1987 didn't occur magically all at once in 1987. That was the new criteria, but it's taken really 10 years now for as we advance for improvements in physician awareness, educators, and families. And in fact, children have to present and be in school 7, 8 years, 9 years, 10 years of age before they really present ASD or autism spectrum disorder strong symptoms that make them able to be recognized and be diagnosed and evaluated. I would argue that that drop-off really are children who could have benefited from the diagnosis who were never diagnosed and not because there's been some change in the frequency of those conditions.
Well, thank you, and thanks for everybody coming, and we'll see some of you, I guess, on Thursday in Hibbing. So, we're adjourned.